This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, COVID cases rising around the world have us more eager than ever for a therapeutic or vaccine. The CEO of drug maker Merck, Ken Frazier, says it might be a while.
As it relates to the vaccines, given the timetable now, we don't yet have data. I would say that there's no way that we can think that they would be broadly available before mid-2021, but I'm optimistic that they will be available at that time.
Tech CEOs returned virtually to Capitol Hill yesterday. Did conservatives make the case against Silicon Valley monopolies? Former Obama White House official Anish Chopra.
As to the public policy risk that they're going to be regulated coming out of this, the probability didn't really move. If anything, it probably weakened it.
Those stories plus Wall Street's worst sell-off in months.
Is it better to really scare people on Monday to make a bottom? The 1900 doesn't feel as bad to me.
No, it doesn't.
It's Thursday, October 29th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box. This is CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. If you look at the damage from this week, the Dow is actually down more than 6% just for the first three sessions this week. It's on pace for its worst weekly performance since late March. The index, of course, lost more than 1,800 points just since the selling began on Friday.
I was coming in thinking, you know, Monday, I was worried about that, like an 1,800 or 1,900 points off. Remember when that happened last time with COVID, COVID resurgence? It was, I don't know, about 3 months ago. We had come back a lot from the March lows, but we're still very, you know, there's a lot of trepidation, a lot of concern. And in one day, it did that. And so I was worried about that on Monday, because that's where you really feel sick, where it's down 1,000. And it came back, was down 650. But then here we are. Took two more days, but we basically got there. 18. Yeah, we basically got there to 1,800. So I'm trying to figure out, is it better to really scare people on Monday to make a bottom? Because it doesn't feel like to me, the 1900 doesn't feel as bad to me as it would have on Monday.
No, it doesn't. And the one concern about that is if you see a bigger drop faster, you're probably more likely to get attention in Washington and maybe the idea that they would come back and try and deal with the stimulus package faster. Because that seems to be the only thing that those in Washington pay attention to.
And, you know, strict, mandated lockdowns versus people just scared to death, it's not that different. We, you know, we may not go the route of Europe, but, you know, even if it, you know, so we may not have lockdowns, but even if people just rein in their ability to go to restaurants and everything else with no stimulus, with no chance of stimulus, because it just doesn't look like it. So we're back where we were. So
or more small business relief. Like that's the other issue. You know, they haven't even said okay on the rest of the PPP funds that are out there for the small businesses that are getting hurt so badly.
Then in the Journal, it was one of the main stories yesterday on the front page. There's like eviction hiatuses that are expiring. And none of these people, a lot of these people still don't have jobs or ability to pay rent. So what happens when they say, okay, you don't just owe last month, you're behind 4 months. So you either come or five months or whatever it is. So, I mean, there's a lot still. I don't want to watch in the future.
The forbearance
cliff
is here. That's what they call it.
I was trying to think of an analogy at the top of the show, and it's like, you ever go into like not swampy land, but you know, there's just a lot of water, and each step that you take, you're not sure it's going to get into where your socks get wet, and you're sort of just trying to find something where you can make it where you need to go, but you don't want to really hit the. And that's what I feel like the market is doing, you know, searching for
soggy ground,
something to support it.
Let's talk about COVID cases, because I think that's honestly, I think that this next story about COVID cases and where we are is going to be really what ultimately moves the market. I think to the point that you were just making, Joe and Becky, this is all now a how quickly can we get out of this, or are we going to get out of this at the rate that we potentially imagined, lockdowns or no, consumer confidence or no. Investors continuing to closely follow the headlines on the spike in coronavirus cases. Let's tell you what's going on. The U.S. reported 80,662 infections yesterday. So those are new infections, setting a record high for daily cases for the third time in 1 week. This was the first time the country has now recorded more than 80,000 cases in one day. Previous high was set last Friday. Here's what White House coronavirus advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci told CNBC's Shep Smith last night.
If things do not change, Shep, if they continue on the course we're on, there's going to be a whole lot of pain in this country with regard to additional cases and hospitalizations and deaths. We are on a very difficult trajectory. We are going in the wrong direction.
Other countries are also concerned they're going in the wrong direction in terms of managing the coronavirus pandemic. In France, President Macron has announced a second lockdown beginning Friday to stem the disease's spread across the country. Germany has also announced a second lockdown amid rising COVID cases there. And Spain and the UK are also seeing upticks in COVID-related hospitalizations. The primary hope for those under renewed lockdown is an effective vaccine or a therapeutic drug. Currently, pharmaceutical companies like Gilead, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and Merck are all working on developing drugs to treat or prevent COVID-19. But it still seems like there's a long way to go. Pharma companies, in addition to their work fighting this pandemic, are focused on next week's presidential election, like everybody else. A pandemic, an election, market volatility, just another day in the C-suite. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Joining us right now is Ken Frazier, chairman and CEO of Merck. And also with us is Jeff Sonnenfeld, senior associate dean for Leadership Studies at the Yale School of Management and a CNBC contributor. Good morning to both of you gentlemen. Ken, I want to start with you, and I want to talk about the voting efforts in just a moment, but given that we're watching this steady rise of COVID cases across the country and frankly the globe right now, and we're watching the market sell off in large part because of that, I wanted to get a sense from you of how you're thinking, Ken, about the timeline with which we may get a vaccine and some of the efforts that you're undertaking in terms of therapeutics and the like, in terms of your partnership with Ridgeback for what could be an oral therapeutic, which I think has a lot of people are hoping has lots of promise.
Good morning, Andrew, and thanks for having me. Let me start by saying there are a lot of companies in our industry working on different approaches to vaccines, and we've heard some good as well as therapeutics. And we've heard some good news recently from Regeneron, from Eli Lilly. We are awaiting news from Pfizer, AstraZeneca, J&J, and others, Moderna and others. So I'm very optimistic that in the near future we will find some of these studies about some of these vaccines and therapeutics are going to be positive. I'm very optimistic about that. As far as what Merck is doing is, let me start with the antiviral. As you know, we are going into phase 2-3 with our direct-acting oral antiviral product that's a partnership with Ridgeback. And what we know so far about that drug is very encouraging. We know that at concentrations that seem to be safe, that it prevents viral replication. And so now the question is, in a large study of 2,700 people, can we show that it actually has an effect on sickness and death, morbidity and mortality? And we're very optimistic about that. Behind that, we actually have two vaccines, one of which has gone into human testing based on our measles virus vector. And again, the goal there is to have a vaccine that can provide durable protection with a single dose. And right behind that is another vacine based on our vesicular stomatitis virus vector, which is the one that we used in Ebola. So we're very optimistic about Merck. Our goal at Merck is to produce medicines that can have an enduring impact on this, not just in the pandemic phase, but also in the endemic phase.
So Ken, just help us. If we were all looking at a calendar, and I know it's hard to prognosticate, but when you talk to family even about your expectations about what the world looks like 6 months out from now, 12 months out from now, when are you expecting a vaccine will be on the market, not necessarily yours, and when are you expecting, I mean, we can talk about the Ridgeback product, because that's something that could be terrific if you could just walk into a CVS or Walgreens and get it if, in fact, you were to be COVID positive.
So starting with the antiviral, we think we'll have at least some interim data on that in early 2021. And we're already spooling up to make millions and millions of doses, and by early next year, much more. So I think if the antiviral works, particularly if it's a capsule, it's an oral that you can take over 5 days, you can then use it more readily with people. They don't have to be in the hospital. You can use it
hopefully earlier in the disease, and if everything works out, you could even use it prophylactically for those people who would be exposed to people who might have coronavirus. So we're very optimistic about that. We think that could make a very important contribution. As it relates to the vaccines, given the timetable now, we don't yet have data, I would say that there's no way that we can think that they would be broadly available before mid-2021, but I'm optimistic that they will be available at that time. And as far as what I'm telling people, you know, my own family, we usually have a very large Thanksgiving dinner. We're not going to have that this year. We think that's not responsible to bring that many people together when we're seeing a surge of coronavirus right now.
And then finally, and then we'll talk about voting in just a moment, but are you thinking by next summer, people are still wearing masks, they're not wearing masks, there's going to be a real need for the,
yes,
the Ridgeback drug, there won't be because so many people will have the vaccine. What does the future look like in your mind?
I don't see the therapeutics that we have or the vaccines that are coming as a silver bullet. I think for the foreseeable future, we're still going to have to practice basic mask wearing, social distancing, hygiene. I think that's with us for a while. And I would say certainly well into 2021, we'll still be trying to observe these public health measures. I'm very optimistic that we're going to have therapeutics and vaccines. I think it's a mistake to tell people, though, that it's a silver bullet. And overnight, we're going to be able to vaccinate enough people, treat enough people. The natural history of these viruses is that they don't go away. We still vaccinate people for measles because measles are still around. So I don't think we should tell people that they can expect to give up on those public health measures anytime soon.
Jeff, I want to bring you into the conversation and pivot a little bit of the discussion to Election Day. We are just 5 days away, and one of the things that's been remarkable to watch over the past month, something that you've been chronicling and supporting in large part behind the scenes, has been an effort by corporate America to help their employees get time off, Ken doing it at Merck, to go and vote. You've said that democracy is at stake here. Speak to what's happening.
Thanks, Andrew. You know, usually when I come on and have the honor of joining you guys on the show, I my goal is to not start too much of a food fight at this hour over breakfast. In this case, my goal is to try to stay out of Ken Frazier's way. I'm sure, like many, are wondering, what's this guy doing on with Ken Frazier's model? And then the segue that you suggest right there actually is a perfect one, because where Ken just took us in talking about, in very realistic terms, where we're going in terms of virology and therapeutics is so realistic. Talking about the middle of next year, we had a great model that Ken has set with his peers in the pharma industry, and nine of them, of course, signing this this incredible statement that we're not going to be rushed by politics at a time where we're candidly just between us. The president was saying in Labor Day there could be some magic bullet out on that very special day of November 3rd. Ken and Alex Gorsky of Johnson & Johnson and their peers said, no, we're not going to rush things. We're going to let the science dictate things, not be have political intervention. That kind of leadership is the gold standard that again, Ken and his peers stand for. And we're seeing that when we look at this coming day, Election Day, it's not just the pharma companies that are saying we have to watch for politics having a poisonous effect, is that we have seen a remarkable degree of CEO encouragement of public-minded spiritedness, that volunteerism to be, we have close to 3,000 employers, have almost a million employees out there volunteering as poll workers and of course, getting the day off to vote. It's just remarkable responsibility that we're seeing. And again, Ken's the gold standard of sparking these kinds of initiatives.
Ken, why do you think this is happening now?
Well, first of all, I think we have to take a step back and realize that this is an election that is being conducted in the midst of a public health crisis, the coronavirus crisis. And so tens of millions of people will be voting in a different way this election through mail. And I think what we have to do as a business community, as well as everyone, the media and anyone else who is privileged to hold a position of public trust and influence, is to encourage people to vote, but also to encourage them to respect the integrity and legitimacy of the actual process. Because of the way in which the election's being conducted right now, it's very likely that we won't know the outcome in some states on election night. And so it's important to encourage people to have the patience, the civility, and the restraint to actually wait for the outcome of the election and to trust the process.
How politicized, can I ask, is it inside your own office, Ken, in terms of just the conversations that are taking place between executives and employees and whatnot about politics right now?
I don't think it's very politicized inside, Merck. I don't think we have a lot of those conversations. We are totally focused, irrespective of who's elected in November 3rd or thereafter. We're totally focused on the challenges that our country faces right now around, for example, the coronavirus, as well as the underlying issues having to do with patient affordability. We want to be able to work with whoever is in office, whatever the new Congress is, whatever the administration is. We need to solve the fundamental problems of affordability and access, and also have a system that actually encourages investment for future medicines and vaccines that we need for future pandemics, for example.
I want to take it just real quickly while we have Ken here. I want to take it to drug prices, and it pains me to see that you don't have a lot of friends left, I think, Ken. I don't know which side of the aisle you would appeal to for logic, because I hear worse stuff, I think, coming from the president's side on bringing prices down 70% by reimporting drug controls from Europe. I mean, where do you go? What's going to happen after the election, Ken? Who's your friend this time around that understands that pharmaceuticals are probably the best deal in town for dealing with these chronic illnesses?
Certainly. So let's start with the WHO recently said that the impact on global GDP from the coronavirus is likely to be $26, $28 trillion. So the reality of the world is that if we're going to solve not just the pandemic, but the chronic health conditions that you just referred that are costing us so much money, the best solutions are often pharmaceuticals and vaccines. And so I have to believe in the logic of people. I have to believe that people are of goodwill and they want to solve the problem of patient affordability. I think the fundamental problem isn't simply the price of drugs. It's the structure of insurance benefits. It's the middlemen. It's everything in the system that misaligns incentives so that the person at the pharmacy counter isn't getting the benefit of the rebates, for example, that we're paying, which are about 50%. So I have to say that while we don't have a lot of, quote, friends, I think there are a lot of people who want to fix the situation in a way that's good for the country, good for the economy, and good for patients.
I just wanted to hear about that because it worries me about innovation and everything else because...
thanks, Joe. I was just going to reinforce the point, anticipating where you might have been going, is that in looking at these time frame issues, unlike some activist investor pressures that have torn apart some other pharma companies, can still, I think, invest 12 to 15% of that almost $50 billion in revenues in long-term solutions. But also this CEO engagement is so critical for public trust. All these virus remedies that come out there, whether or not they're the therapies or the vaccines, don't matter if people aren't going to take them. And we have seen since April, the public trust has so collapsed the support for taking these vaccines. It was roughly 75% back in April, 72-75%. It's fallen now, according to Morning Consult, to less than 40%. And public trust, again, spilling into next week's elections. An overnight survey just done last night by Morning Consult tells us most of the nation, 62% of the nation, is afraid the Supreme Court may have to intervene to select the president. And they're very worried about that. And they're looking to CEOs like Ken and others to use their voices to bring calm. So, in fact, I think it was 72% over last night have told us of American voters they want CEOs' voices involved. And sure enough, what did we see yesterday? But we saw the Business Roundtable, the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and five other diverse business groups unify, and it's not usually what they do, with a very loud statement saying we believe in a peaceful transfer of power, and we're hoping for that, and to have calm through Election Day, and as Ken said, wait till all the ballots are counted, that given the surge of voters that we have this year on top of the mail-ins, it's going to take a while to count the ballots, and we always wait till after Election Day. But unfortunately, the president and Justice Kavanaugh also have recently said it all has to be by November 3rd, or it's going to look like manipulation.
Ken, let me ask you a question. Well, as we've been doing this interview, I just got an email from a viewer effectively making a critique suggesting that the efforts by corporate America to encourage voting is not a politically agnostic act, that the conversation around a peaceful transfer of power is not a politically agnostic act, in large part because the president, President Trump, has made noises about whether the vote is going to be rigged or other things like that. And in fact, that the efforts by corporate America are really an anti-President Trump effort. What do you tell that viewer?
See, I think that comment is reflective of the sad situation we have in our country where everything is politicized. I think this issue around the process goes beyond personalities. It goes beyond parties. It's our birthright as a nation to actually have free and fair elections. Going back to the Declaration of Independence, we say that the just powers of the government are derived from the consent of the governed. And that consent is actually expressed through free and fair elections. This is what we were taught in civics, and it's unfortunate that people see every one of these things through a political lens. From my perspective, this is really about our birthright as American citizens, and frankly, the fact that we have been for many, many years a model of what it means to have a representative democracy for the rest of the world.
We've always had ballot counts, too, for military ballots and provisional ballots have always been counted after Election Day. And there are several states, Colorado and I think, you know, eight or so states that are fully mail-in ballots. And it takes a while, of course, to get them all counted. You know, I think it was Einstein who said that physics is easy. It's politics that's complicated.
Gentlemen, Ken and Jeff, we want to thank you both for joining us. Ken, thank you for helping us through all of these issues around COVID. And, of course, to both of you gentlemen for getting out the word on voting. We appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm optimistic about coronavirus and I'm optimistic about our democracy.
Thank you.
Next on Squawk Pod, a Senate committee questioned the CEOs of Facebook, Google, and Twitter on competitiveness and content moderation. Former White House Chief Technology Officer Anish Chopra says it was all politics.
The hearing itself wasn't designed to foster more cooperation and learning, unlike the House antitrust hearing last month, where I think we learned a lot as a country about how the platforms operate.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Good morning. Welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan.
Today is the busiest day of earnings season. You've got Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, and Facebook, the big names to watch. But yesterday, the focus was in Washington, with the CEOs of Twitter, Facebook, and Alphabet testifying before a Senate panel. Elon Mui joins us right now. She's got the headlines from that. And Elon, this got pretty heated.
Oh, yeah, Becky, this was a knockdown, drag-out political brawl, and not just between the senators and the CEOs, but also between the Republicans and the Democrats. GOP Senator Ted Cruz threw the most punches, primarily aimed at Twitter's Jack Dorsey. He accused the company of trying to censor conservatives when the company restricted tweets around the New York Post story on Hunter Biden.
Mr. Dorsey, who the hell elected you and put you in charge of what the media are allowed to report and what the American people are allowed to hear? And why do you persist in behaving as a Democratic super PAC?
Dorsey did defend the company's content moderation policies, but he said the rules still apply to the president.
Just to be clear, we have not censored the president. We have not taken the tweets down that you're referencing. They have more context than a label applied to them. And we do the same for leaders around the world.
At the same time, Democrats called the hearing a sham, and they pushed the companies to be even more aggressive in policing their own platform and to stand up to Republicans.
What we are seeing today is an attempt to bully the CEOs of private companies into carrying out a hit job on a presidential candidate by making sure that they push out foreign and domestic misinformation meant to influence the election.
Now, this hearing did not move the ball at all, but it did lay bare some of the bitter politics around this issue heading into the election, and the tech companies were caught in the middle. Becky.
Yeah, Elon, a tough place to be for any of these guys yesterday, but thank you. Joining us right now is Anish Chopra. He is former White House Chief Technology Officer under President Obama. He's now president of Care Journey. And Anish, probably not surprising to see it kind of break out into a fight like this with less than a week to go before the election. But kind of getting through all of the noise, what does this mean for these tech companies after this? They're in a no-win position.
Well, you know, Elon was right that punches were thrown, but none of them landed. So they may have been uncomfortable sitting in the room taking some heat. But as to the public policy risk that they're going to be regulated coming out of this, the probability didn't really move. If anything, it probably weakened it because it showed the fissure between the two parties about what reform looks like.
I guess it matters a lot who wins the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, there are clearly, you heard pockets of this in the hearing when there was less temperature, bipartisan efforts around the Honest Ads Act or even the PACT Act, which would basically create some baseline transparency provisions on content moderation. So there were crumbs, if you watched, to see that there could be a deal. But the hearing itself wasn't designed to foster more cooperation and learning, unlike the House antitrust hearing last month, where I think we learned a lot as a country about how the platforms operate. Today or yesterday was mostly about, you know, in my opinion, you know, working the refs in advance of the election.
Mr. Zuckerberg, are you the ref?
Senator, I certainly think not, and I do not want us to have that role.
Mr. Dorsey, are you the ref?
No.
Mr. Pashai, are you the ref?
Senator, I do think we make content moderation decisions, but we are transparent about it, and we do it to protect users. But we really believe and support maximizing freedom of expression.
Look, you have a situation, though, with 230. It makes sense that these companies are no longer just billboards anymore. We're just, you know, posting boards for things. They have gotten involved with moderating discussion and with trying to set some guidelines, and that does make them much more like a publisher. How does that not change at some point?
Well, there was one exchange in the hearing yesterday. I think it was Senator Cory Gardner. He did get all three platforms to admit content that they generate should be treated like published content. And now the question is, you know, how far can one interpret what that means? Would support for paid ads be subject to a different standard than perhaps what you and I might post as individual users? So there was maybe an inkling of how to go forward on balancing what's been the bedrock of internet regulation in the backstop of a real serious problem. I will say we have, you saw the fissure between the platforms themselves. Twitter clearly on the side of an open internet, focusing on new entrants, lower barriers to entry, and perhaps others in the hearing talking a bit more about investing the resources necessary to comply with new regs. And so that may be another thread to look for in the coming months.
Yeah, I would say some of them would clearly like to see new regulations coming so that they don't have to be the ones who are deciding this. Zuckerberg has said that, and it seemed pretty clear that Sundar Pichai is kind of the same mindset with that. But look, if you're talking about regulations not coming, and because the Democrats and the Republicans can't agree on this, you are going to continue to see this heat on the companies being brought by certain senators and probably higher up than that. And what kind of backlash does that mean for these companies? Even if you don't get regulation that does this, you're going to have a lot of Americans who are mad at them, angry at them, and potentially don't want to use their services.
Yeah, look, to me, and I think we've talked about this before, the industry has very clear opportunities for collaboration on some of these difficult issues, like what's defined as misinformation and how to treat it when it's introduced into the system. So I do think there's a chance to balance the kind of let content moderation flourish as in sort of an open marketplace where you could go from no moderation to AI-powered human-engineered efforts, but still have some consistency on fake news or a number of other content categories. The industry can do more to self-regulate, and it hasn't stepped up to the level it could, as we've seen in areas like child exploitation, for example, or even on cybersecurity threats, where there's a little bit more of a consensus approach, where it's not my choice versus yours, platform A versus B. Let's together solve something in a more collaborative, multi-stakeholder way. So we can solve this better as an industry. Their willingness to work together is a function of the heat they feel of regulation coming, and we're not there yet.
I mean, that's crazy to me, the idea that they can't even agree on child pornography and making sure that they try and get rid of that. That's where you lose.
On that, child exploitation is the one area where we have an area of collaboration. where the industry does have a common view about what constitutes child porn, and then every platform uses that definition to kind of remove content. So we have models. That's the one positive light in what is otherwise a complicated stew. I'm on the side of this is more of a disinformation spreading problem than a conservative silencing problem. Maybe that's an obvious statement coming from me, but that's, if you said where's the problem, I think it's about election interference and spreading disinformation.
We do continue to see interference. We recently disclosed actions we took on both Russia and actions originating out of Iran.
We do continue to see coordinated influence operation attempts. We've been very vigilant. We appreciate the cooperation we get from intelligence agencies, and as companies, we are sharing information.
Like Jack and Sundar, you know, we also see continued attempts by Russia and other countries, especially Iran and China, to run these kind of information operations.
That is the root of the issue we need more consensus to solve.
Anish, thank you. It's good talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Squawk Pod. We'll be right back. That's Squawk Pod for today. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern to get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears. Subscribe to Squawk Pod on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.